is coming your way.
Scotty Madison, Scotty Madison, true life stories to make your day. Scotty Madison.
Yeah, we're gonna learn from his brand new book. You make the difference. It ain't the duck. It's not the duck. It's not the duck.
Scotty Madison.
Beast the walk and the talk.
It's not the duck.
Beast the walk and the talk.
It's not the duck.
Welcome to another episode of It's Not the Duck. It's where we talk about the everything else that makes the difference in your life, the walk and the talk. Today, it's quite an honor for me to have guest Larry Schmitto on the call today. Coach Schmitto was my baseball coach for a couple years at Vanderbilt, but he is quite an accomplished man. He currently owns S&S Family Entertainment, which are actually bowling centers across the country in Tennessee, Ohio, Kentucky and Indiana. There are about a dozen bowling centers. But his first love wasn't bowling. It was baseball. And it started up, you'll hear today, Coach grew up very poor. He became a school teacher, a high school coach, a college baseball coach, the head of recruiting for SEC football team, a business partner with some of the greatest country music stars of all time, a baseball executive, an owner of 8 minor league baseball teams, 2 minor league basketball teams, and a couple of hockey teams. And then also for a period of 3 years, he was the head of marketing for the Texas Rangers. Quite an accomplished man. I'm sure from Coach Schmitto, we're going to hear what are his ideas on what makes the difference in your walk and talk in your life. So welcome, Coach Larry Schmitto. How are you this morning, Coach?
I'm doing fine, Scotty. Hope you are.
Yes, sir, I am. You know, for our listeners here, Coach, I'm going to tell you right now, I've had great respect for you for a long, long time. I don't think I'll ever be able to pay you back for recruiting me to come to Vanderbilt and play both football and baseball. You were my baseball coach for a couple seasons, general manager when I was with the Sounds. But, you know, I guess I looked up to you since 1976, Coach. That is 48 years.
Well, that's quite a compliment. I appreciate it, and I certainly enjoyed coaching you.
Well, I appreciate that, Coach. Well, listen, I've told the listeners ahead of time before you came out about your success as a bowling magnet, and that's kind of where we ended. But I want to talk about some of your early days coming up in West Nashville. I know you were born in West Nashville. Tell me about your parents, and I guess it was Egbert and Jane Ann, and tell me about growing up in West Nashville.
Well, I did grow up close to the Nations. We called it Lower West Nashville. You know, we didn't have much money, but we had a lot of family ties. We had a little small acreage where we would farm. My dad was a disabled veteran, so his pension wasn't very big, but we never missed any meals. I was gifted with a mother that valued education and certainly wanted me to go to college, and went to Cone High. And my coach introduced me to coaching as a junior. As my junior year, they started a knothole program, little league age. And my buddy and I went over to Cockrell School, and we didn't know how to do it. So it was about 100 little kids there. And one kid walked up to me. We were choosing up sides, and said, pick Deardorff. He's the best player. I picked Deardorff, my captain. He picked all the good players. My buddy wound up with a bad team. I wound up with a championship team and wound up falling in love with coaching.
You know, that's a great story. I was reading a little bit about the history, and it's really kind of odd, Coach. At the same time, I think you were playing baseball, and then also you started coaching the lower knothole leagues. That just doesn't happen much. What did you really enjoy most, or just really got a great deal of satisfaction out of both of them?
Well, playing ball, you know, you, as you well know, you love the competition, and you know, I loved winning, and so you know, and I enjoyed being around the kids, and you know, after that I moved on up to the 13 to 15 year old and the 16 to 18, and I guess I was a pretty good recruiter because I wound up with all the good players in Nashville. We went to a lot of tournaments, carried a lot of those folks on over to Vanderbilt. And so, you know, I just thoroughly enjoyed it. It wasn't like today where you have official travel teams. But we would go and play some of the better teams outside of Nashville and had a lot of success at that, and that led to me getting offered the Vanderbilt job.
Well, I'm going to get to that in a minute, but I want to go here. You personally, when you grew up in high school, obviously your dad being disabled, he probably didn't get a chance to play a lot of catch with you out there. Was there a you mentioned a high school coach. I mean, what got you into sports initially, and what sports did you play in high school?
Well, I played basketball, wasn't real good at it, but we did go to state tournament. I went to Cone High, and I was supposed to go to Bellevue Zone there. My mother wanted me to take different courses. And so, you know, really the Nashville Vols were on the radio, went to Suffordale a couple of times, just loved the sport. Thinking person, you know, especially when I got into coaching, of little things that go into making a play, how you adjust different hitters, all those things just intrigued me. It's kind of, you know, baseball to me is kind of like, you know, an artist is to a painting. You know, it's, you know, you got to put all the pieces together to make a good team. And I love those challenges. I love playing the good teams. I didn't want to play the bad teams. I want to play the good ones. And, you know, I always hoped to play professional baseball, but I wasn't quite good enough to do that. Kept playing, though, in the summer leagues and enjoyed coaching and playing.
Well, you know, Coach, you know, you looking back, you went to Bailey Junior High School, and I can understand you coached football, basketball, and track. Now, I'm not sure if you ran track. I think your speed was probably maybe a little bit better than mine, which means it wasn't that good. So I'm not sure how you.
I had deceiving speed. I was even slower than I looked.
Well, and then you went to basketball coaching at Goodlettsville High School. You know, I want to hear the story where you're over there and coaching probably baseball and basketball over there, and you get a call from Coach Jess Neely. Tell me about that and how the Vanderbilt connection came about.
Well, one of my players, Ava Jones' father, was on the athletic committee at Vanderbilt, was a professor, and he had told Mr. Neely about my summer coaching. And unbeknownst to me, Mr. Neely showed up at Goodlettsville High, and I went to the office, and this is 1968, I guess. And he said, "I want you to be our Vanderbilt baseball coach." And I'd been a territorial scout during those years for Cleveland, so I'd watched the Vanderbilt program. So I shouldn't have said it, but I did. I said, "Why would I want to do that? Y'all are awful." and Mr. Neely said, "Yes, we are, but I want to change that." And I just initially, every now and then you meet a person that you just initially believe in that person, integrity. Mr. Neely was one of those. He said, if he said something, he's going to do it. He did it. So that's how I wound up at Vanderbilt.
Well, you joined them in 1968, and of course, you mentioned about there were a few people in my experience, Coach. I mean, I certainly believed you, and you recruited me, and I believed Dr. Rob Roy Purdy, and then I met Mr. Fred Russell one time, and I truly believed everything he said, and I think you'd certainly validate that. But, you know, and you don't have to make a comment on this, but, you know, I will, and then we'll go on to something else. I mean, baseball started a long time ago, and it actually started with you. I mean, I'll talk to people today, and, you know, that they'll talk about how that baseball really didn't begin until the Coach Corbin era, and they've done a great job. He's an incredible coach. They've accomplished much. They've reached the highest level. But I would say, Coach, when you got started, I mean, it's not like you had a pocket full of scholarships and you had a nice field to work with. Tell me about some of those limitations that you had in getting going, and why would you take on this dream?
Well, we didn't have any scholarships when we started, and didn't even have a pitching screen to throw batting practice to. Had a very limited budget of travel and all. And so, but Mr. Neely told me to help me, and I had a pitcher by summer team. He wound up in the big leagues, Mike Willis. And I think he gave Mike Heif a scholarship after that first year. And the next year, he helped me get John McClain. And that's a big, big plus for us during that time was Jeff Peebles. Great football, high school football player, even better baseball player. And that's when he came to Vanderbilt. There's another starting pitcher. A lot of my summer league guys sacrificed and came to Vanderbilt on financial aid scholarships. We finally worked our way up to 3 scholarships, but I still think we are the only team in Vanderbilt in any sport to win back-to-back SEC championships in 73 and 74.
I believe that is absolutely true. And you may have had a total of 4 scholarships by that time.
No, I only had 3, but again, we throw a football player like yourself, Jeff Peebles, Steve Berger, every now and then a basketball player before they started playing so many games. Joe Ford was a good baseball player, and Mark Elliott. So we had a few just walk-ons that turned out to be real good ball players. I mean, Tommy Powell hit the most historic home run ever in Vanderbilt history, I think, and he is just a walk-on.
You know, Coach, you shared with me one time a story that not only did you not have scholarships, and you talked about not having a batting screen. I think you had to go make that yourself due to desperation and not getting hurt. But I think I was told one time Mr. Pete Naylor didn't actually give a lot of baseballs out during that time when you had a ball game.
Well, we'd start with 3, and we'd have to put a guy out on the street to make sure a foul ball didn't go down that manhole cover over there. And I guess if we completely ran out, he'd give it. He was in charge of those things for 1 year. Fortunately, after that, that changed a little bit with Mr. Neely being the AD. And so, but we had so, I really, Vanderbilt didn't care. I guess they had to have a baseball team when I went there to fill out some sports, basketball and football, no women's sports. So I was in a different era. I understand that. And all sports have changed so much since then, some for the good, some for the bad.
You know, Coach, obviously your ability to get players to come to Vanderbilt just because they wanted to come there and play for you and be there is quite a compliment. And I guess they saw that in football because you became the head of recruiting for football. Share the story about who was the most important person in a school that you would go and visit when you were trying to recruit a Scotty Madison or a Mike Wright or whoever it might be.
If possible, when I was, as I was on the road all the time in football recruiting, and I wanted to see the guidance counselor, I wanted to talk to the coach, but if I could talk to the janitor and say, what kind of guy is this Scotty Madison? Janitors knew everything went on in that school. If he said, oh, he come back behind the gym all the time and smokes, he runs with a rough crowd. Or if he said, hey, he's a good Christian young man, he works hard, he comes from good parents. Man, janitors know everything.
It is interesting. As you told me that story, I remember the janitor would just sit in the corner and class would start and change, and they'd be over there just watching everything that took place in the hallway. That was such a great tip. Yeah. Well, Coach, when did you know that it was time to get out of coaching and you wanted to become a baseball executive and you had this dream you wanted to start the Nashville Sounds?
Well, the NCAA passed a rule that couldn't have full-time recruiters on the road, and Bamba cut my salary. And I have 5 kids that got this terrible habit of wanting to eat. So... I always thought Nashville would support a minor league baseball team. And Chattanooga had brought it back, so I kind of studied them. And George Sisler in Columbus, Ohio, had done the same. So I went to the fair board and asked them about the park board, and asked them about building a park. And they said, oh, no, we can't do that. But we got some property over there on at Fort Negley that we're going to replace the softball fields. If you build a stadium, we'll let you go there. So that's how I started out. And not knowing what I was getting into, I have to be honest, if I'd known what I was getting into, I wouldn't have done it because it was hard.
Well, not only is it hard, you had to sell shares, you had to take a $30,000 loan, you took a mortgage out on your house, and then you had to work with folks, I guess, like Jerry Reed or Conway Twitty, the Oak Ridge Boys. How encouraging and helpful was Conway Twitty? I know he loved baseball, but how encouraging was he during this time when you were really going through a hard road to try to bring pro sports to Nashville, Tennessee?
Well, if it hadn't been for Conway, I couldn't have done it. I didn't know Conway, but I'd had his son, Jimmy Jenkins, in my baseball camp, and a guy named Snuffy Miller that played the drums, I think, was for Conway's son. He was a big Vanderbilt fan, and he said, Conway won't see you. There'd been a little picture in the paper of what the stadium would look like if we could do it. And so he called me out there, and he said, we were trying to sell 5% shares to limited partners. And he said, I'll buy them all. And so, but some of his advisors said, don't do that. That's too much. So, you know, he wound up getting 20%, but he wound up bringing in Cal Smith, L.E. White. He said, if, I told you I would, if I can't sell them all, I'll buy them. And then Jerry Reed had been a friend through Vanderbilt for years, and he'll stand up on a coaching tower back there in football. And I said, I need to talk to you, Jerry. And so, what about Nicole? And I said, well, I need you to buy at least 5% of this minor league baseball team. How much it cost? I said, $15,000. I said, okay, I'll do that. And I get out of my way, I get back coaching this football team.
You know, you mentioned Jerry Reed, if I may share a story. I guess you had him call me, too, during recruiting or something, because he had just come out with Smokey and the Bandit and, you know, Eastbound and Down, that song. And he called me up. We became friends. And, Coach, I don't know if you knew this or not, but my freshman year, Jerry was going to Oklahoma. Well, you know, when Vanderbilt played out there at Oklahoma and could have beat him and should have beat him out there, Jerry was doing a state fair out there. So he invited myself and old Roger West to travel with him out there on his jet. Well, on the way back, he had a telephone in that plane. And I said, hey, you know, can I call my granny? You know, my granny was always wanting to know where I was or what was going on. He said, sure. So I called granny up. She said, youngin, what you doing? I said, well, Granny, I'm 30,000 feet in the air with Jerry Reed. She goes, oh, no, you're not. And Jerry grabbed the phone. He goes, Granny, Jerry Reed, when you're hot, you're hot.
That sounds just like him, man. Well, I miss him every day.
Oh, I know, me too. And but Conway, you know, he was very good, big baseball fan. I know when he came down in a concert down in the Strawberry Festival in Lakeland, I bet I had 20 baseball players that showed up over there and met him, and he, you know, entertained them, and just a fantastic guy. So you got the Nashville Sounds up and going, and certainly, man, a major feat. You had to try to build a stadium. Unlike today when the city is helping the Titans build a billion-dollar stadium, I mean, you couldn't even probably get $1.5 million financed through anybody. So that was a difficult time, but it happened. But opening day, you know, as things become bittersweet. Your mom died on opening day for the Nashville Sounds, didn't she?
The original open day, we actually got it postponed, but yes, she did. She'd been sick for a long time. My mother and I were so close, and I was still coaching at Vanderbilt, and I forget who we were playing, but my wife came and got me out of the dugout to tell me that bad news, and it was hard, and But she lived a good life, and you know, the people came. You know that movie, you know, build it, they'll come. That was true with us. We didn't ever expect as many people to show up as they did.
Well, you end up, not only did that show up, I think for 7 years in a row, the Nashville Sounds led at least the Southern League in attendance. I'm not sure where you stood across the country with everybody else. So this was a big deal. I mean, I've met some pretty good country music stars and entertainers that they said they would come out there and watch games all the time. And I think your goal was just to get people in the seats, and you figure you're going to try to make your living selling souvenirs and popcorn. Isn't that right?
Well, I want to make it affordable. We had $2 in admission ticket for, I think, first 5 or 6 years. And, you know, baseball, especially the minor leagues, I knew one thing going in, that just the game itself was not going to sell itself because the players come and go. So you wasn't like the old days where the Nashville Vols own their own players. You know, I knew going in that, hey, we might get a great player for a week and he's moved up or he's released or he's traded. So we tried to promote the team, not the player, and a souvenir for kids to get that name out there to put a logo on a t-shirt, a hat, a bat, a ball, that the kids would grow up as Sounds fans, and that worked. And so every weekend we, you know, was giving something away, and during the week we was having discounts, and so took a little bit of everything. None of that's changed a lot. The Dodgers made a habit of doing that.
Well, Coach, I can remember I'm drafted out of Vanderbilt. I signed for a whopping $12,000 with Calvin Griffith because he has no money at all. I'm the second catcher in the whole draft, and I play in Orlando. And I'm excited because we're coming back to play Nashville. I'm coming back home. And I hear there's a one of your promotions is Strikeout Scotty Madison Night. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and I did that with Rick Duncan, too. you know, we would discount a beer or a soda. And unfortunately, we couldn't strike you out.
Well, you didn't strike me. I kicked out a swing at the first pitch, but I did have my friends that came and watched the game. They said, hey, man, will you just take one for the team so we can get a half-price beer?
Yeah.
So it was working in their minds, Coach. I will tell you that.
Well, right.
Well, you had the Reds here, and then you had the Yankees. Tell me a little bit about George Steinbrenner. To me, he was a fascinating man. He kind of had a bad reputation for people that didn't really know him, but I've always heard that people who knew him well, he was just a really man of high character, and he always honored his word.
He did, and that you had a business here at the Bridge Company at that time, and he wanted to be in Nashville. And when we signed with them, he said, what can I do to help you? Okay, we got this old-timers dinner. Come on down. He heard Vanderbilt was going to play UT. He asked about, well, what are they playing now? I said, I don't see many people. I said, well, why don't I give him $10,000 and have him play over at Greer, which he did. He gave money to the Old Timers Association. And then anything that I asked of him, he always did. He got real close to Black Cat Riley, the notorious bat boy in Nashville, and took care of him. But also, Mr. Garrett wanted to get an eye cornea transplant center built. He asked me if I'd get George to come down and be roasted. Absolutely, I'd be there. And he brought Mickey Mantle, Whitey Ford, Roger Merrill, Marvis Mar Thornberry with him. Raised $100,000 through that and gave Vanderbilt $100,000. I believe it's still on campus, the Jones Steinbrenner eye cornea transplant.
Fantastic.
So, you know, and many other stories you've heard. Some of the ones were pretty bad stories, and they were probably true, too. He would fire people. He asked me one time, so why don't you come work for me? And I said, well, I don't know, George, you'd fire me, but the good thing is you keep paying me after you fired me. So, but He wanted to win. That was one thing about him. He wanted to win at the major league level. All of a sudden, we win the playoffs, and Browning, I forget his first name now, pitched a perfect game for the Reds. You'd know it.
Tom Browning.
He just showed up, and I said, what are you doing? He said, George, why don't we come down and help y'all win? That's he, you know, next year was up there full time with Reds, I guess. But, you know, it's just things like that. He wanted to win double A, single A. No matter where he was, he wanted to win.
Well, he did win. And, you know, I thought it was kind of a crazy story all about him and Billy Martin. I never understood all that. But it was very interesting watching it all. Well, Coach, you know, I can remember looking and coming to the ballpark, and I would see Mike and Steve and the rest of your family. Man, you'd have your kids out there. They'd be hawking ice cream and popcorn and whatever else. I mean, how important was it for you to teach your kids the importance of work? And do you think it's important right now in this young generation to understand the value of a dollar and get your butt out there and work?
Well, absolutely. And not only that, just, you know, having your family together in a trashy thing where you're away a lot helped me during that time. But, you know, I taught mine one time. I had to discipline one of my own because it didn't show up for work. That, you know, comes with consequences. You know, if you accept something, my daddy and mama always told me, if you tell somebody you're going to do something, you better do it. If something comes up that totally prevents you from doing that, you better call and tell them, hey, I know I told you, but I can't do it, and here's why. So, you know, I just think, you know, a person's word is so valuable, and work habits are so valuable. And, you know, you build up a history real quick. Dependable or he's not dependable, truthful or not truthful, hardworking or not hardworking. And if you cross all the T's and dot all the I's, you'll be successful.
That's true, Coach. Well, Coach, in 1978 and in 1980 and 81, you won what was the Larry McPhail Award for promotions, which is quite an honor. So with that background, in June of 1990, you headed up a group in Nashville, some pretty distinguished businessmen. I know you had Eddie Arnold do a video about Nashville, and you were up against some other teams. Eventually, Colorado Rockies and the Florida Marlins were awarded programs. And in Colorado, I can remember playing out there with the Denver Zephyrs. They didn't draw anybody. In Florida right now probably has the worst attendance than there is in baseball. How disappointing was it for you to walk away from that and not receive an MLB team?
Well, it was real disappointing. I called Bill White, and we all knew that Denver was probably going to get a franchise. But, you know, it had a stadium. We didn't have a stadium and couldn't get firm commitments. Then Governor McWhorter went with us to make the presentation. He said, you give him that, we'll get that stadium. We had a site picked out. But it was disappointing. But I do know this. That started the movement of the Oilers. A friend of mine, Mr. McClure, was working for Houston, and his job was to get a stadium. And it was the same job when I was with the Rangers. He was a marketing manager of the White Sox. So as soon as it was over, he called me to check on all the demographics of Nashville. And so didn't surprise me when they came calling to Nashville. So I think that maybe a little thing, you know, the work we did helped get the Titans here.
Coach, I would believe that be absolutely the truth. Well, you're a man of great humility, very humble, and but I'm gonna roll off some awards here, and I'm going to ask you a question when it's over. In 2006, you're inducted in the Tennessee Sports Hall of Fame. 2016, the Southern League Hall of Fame. Recently, the Vanderbilt Hall of Fame. American Associated Executive of the Year in 1987 and 89. The Fred Russell, which I think that's incredible, Lifetime Achievement Award, with the Nashville Sports Council in 2011. You were the SEC Coach of the Year either in 73 or 74. Are any of those more meaningful than the others? Is there any of those that stand out that when you received it, you were going, wow, it was like a reality check that what you've had to overcome in your life?
Well, just because his name's on it, Fred Russell Award, means more than all those others. You know, I just was blessed and honored that I had great players that won me those awards. I didn't, you know, if I had players, you can be the greatest coach in the world. If you don't have the players, you're going to lose.
That's true.
You know, I just, probably the SEC Coach of the Year, it always went to everyone in the division in 73 and 74. Only because that team I'd coached some. Chuck Boyett was on that team. Chuck Boyett played for me from the time he was 8 years old till he was 22.
That's unbelievable.
And so, you know, I had a lot of others that played for me from the time I was 13 to 22, Reason Over, people like that, and Peebles. And you know, when you win those things, and the Vanderbilt Hall of Fame, to know how, you know, you talked about sacrifice I might have made. You went through those sacrifices. It was a little bit better when you were there, but, you know, sports weren't as important back then at Vanderbilt as it is now.
That's true.
To the administration. And so, you know, you didn't have what the other teams in the SEC had. And certainly we didn't have. So our players knew that. I used to tell them, hey, our field's not the best, but we know where every rock is. So, you know, it should be an advantage to you. And I told Mew Burnett, I said, and Roy worked hard to get that stadium built. And he deserves some credit for that.
He certainly
and
does.
And so, you know, it the sacrifices those guys made, you know, traveling places in your own cars, the rinky old bus, you know, not having much meal money. I knew what my players had been through. So those two awards at Vanderbilt, SEC Coach of the Year, meant a whole lot more to me than a couple others did, because I knew the sacrifices that my players had made to win me those two.
Well, that's a great answer. Coach, you were a teacher, you were a high school coach, a college coach, a baseball executive, professional sports owner of baseball, maybe 10 to dozen teams, hockey teams, minor league basketball teams, and you were one time an executive of the Texas Rangers. If you had one day you could go back and do one thing, which one would it be and why?
Oh, my gosh. That's an impossible question to answer, I guess. I guess the one day would be, even though I had a heavy heart, would be that date in 1978 when Greer Stadium opened.
Wow, that's great. Yeah, you overcome a lot on that one. And I was very proud to be a Nashville Sound and come through here during that time. It was a very special time for Nashville, and you think about it, that was the only professional sports, but in the area, that was it, you know, at the time. And look what we have now. We've got the Titans, we've got hockey, the Predators, we've got John Ingram's soccer team, still have the Nashville Sounds. Imagine Nashville with a one professional sports. And so, I mean, Coach Mintz, hats off and appreciate that.
Well, I'm proud that we were able to build that stadium on our own and stood there for 30-some-odd years, so I guess it was a good investment for the city.
Well, Coach, as we always end, it's not the duck, and we sure appreciate your time. Like I said, you were an inspiration to me and so many others. Your players love playing for you. There'll be a day, Coach, when you step into eternity, and how does Coach Larry Smitto want to be remembered by his family and friends and everybody who's ever been around him? How do you want to remember the day you step into eternity?
I would hope they would remember me as a person that tried to do his best, was fair to everybody, respected people, and that honored him, and that tried to help everybody that he could possibly help. And he appreciated it, and know that I appreciate every day that I had with him.
Well, Coach, I think you've accomplished that, and you've got a wonderful wife in Ms. Schmitto. I've known her a long time, and your kids are great. And I thank you and congratulate you on your accomplishments and being a bowling magnet. And next time we'll have you on the show, we'll have to talk about what's the highest bowling round you've ever done, or actually, have you ever bowled?
Oh, yeah, I bowled, and it won't take long to talk about my highest game. it only compares to my running speed.
Well, Coach, take care. God bless, and you have a wonderful day. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Scotty. Bye.
This episode of It's Not the Duck is brought to you by Get Carried Away. When you're looking for that perfect home-cooked low-country meal for your family on a Sunday afternoon, or dinner options to impress your guests, look no further than Get Carried Away. Go to getcarriedawaypi.com.
Well, if I had Aladdin's lamp for only a day, I'd make a wish, and here's what I'd say. Oh, nothing could be finer than to be in Carolina eating. I get carried away.